Hi, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Toy Harp, a podcast about bluegrass. This is the last episode of season two. Here from Nashville is my conversation with Allison Krauss.
I remember, you know, the first time I looked out in the audience and saw people singing words to our songs that only we had recorded. That was just a really crazy moment. Just never thought it'd end up being there. Never thought we'd hear back from Rounder. Yeah. Never thought we would hear from Rounder in the first place.
If this is your first time listening, you can hear full interviews with Jerry Douglas, Allison Brown, Bela Fleck, Larry Sparks, Jody Stecker, and so many more wherever you get your podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Later on.
And welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. I'm your host, Cindy Howes, and thank you so much for finding this podcast today. We're going to be talking to Bob Hillman, which is a name that I hadn't heard in quite some time. I ran into Bob a few years ago at a folk music conference called Folk Alliance, and he was like, "I'm back. I'm doing music again. I'd love to be on your podcast." So we've been chatting for a few years. He released this acoustic EP that was really rad, and we decided, let's do it. We had a great conversation. Looking forward to having you hear that. Before we get into it, let's talk about ways to stay in touch. You can sign up for Basic Folk's monthly newsletter at our website, basicfolk.com. There's also a link in the show notes. You can stay connected to us through social media. We are at Basic Folk Pod on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube. Listen along there. You can also make a contribution. We're a listener-supported operation. You can give a contribution of $5 or $10 a month or a one-time gift of $50. It really does help keep the lights on and makes everything we do possible. If you are a supporter, thank you so much. High five. If not, there is a link in the show notes, or you can check out basicfolk.com. Bob Hillman had a real thing going on in the early 2000s. He had made waves in New York City, rubbing shoulders with some of the finest songwriters of the era at places like The Open Mic, Fast Folk, and The Living Room. The singer-songwriter was creatively fulfilled, but not gaining the momentum in order to experience strategic growth in folk music. After opening for a long list of dates for Suzanne Vega, Hillman decided it was time to step away and get back to business. School, that is. He got his MBA in marketing and went on to hold a decent-paying job for the next decade and a half, raising his family in the Bay Area. After a layoff, Bob thought, okay, let's dig in again and start writing, recording, and performing music. Since 2016, he's released a couple of albums and an EP or two. The most recent is the mostly acoustic Downtown in the Rain. In our conversation, we talk about what it's like to reignite his creative, entrepreneurial, musical spirit, how he's used that energy in his corporate jobs, and also hoping to one day meet his singing partner on the EP, the great Maria Taylor. We'll take a listen to the title track from the EP, then we'll get to our conversation with Bob Hillman. Here's Downtown in the Rain by Bob Hillman on Basic Folk. Hillman, this is so fun to have you on the podcast. In college, I played your music all the time on the coffee house on WERS. I would see you at Passim. Very fond memories of your live performances, and love that you're back in it. And that we get to have this conversation. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
It's absolutely my pleasure.
All right. Let's start off by talking about practicing in your relationship to learning and practicing. So you've always been interested in music, banging on the piano at your grandma's house. You took lessons, piano, drum, guitar, but you would not practice. I can relate to this. What has been your relationship to learning and practicing in music and beyond?
I find that you have to care in order to get that sort of thing done. And I never cared about guitar shredding, even though my teacher taught me Black Dog at a young age and I enjoyed playing it. I was all about being on the couch and playing songs and singing. And so my practice evolved into that. And in hindsight, it was obvious that any destination would be singer-songwriter related. Mm-hmm. I wasn't super talented as a guitar player. I'm certainly competent, but not inordinately talented. And so I don't think that any signal was going to my brain that said, play a guitar solo over and over again, in a dark room for a week like you hear guitar players say they did when they were young. Mm-hmm. That's just not what I wanted to do. And so I try to lean into what I love doing. And so if I can figure out something on the guitar that will serve a song, I will figure that thing out and ask for help if I need it, mm-hmm. or even go online if there's a chord missing. I love the idea of being a more sophisticated guitar player and musician overall, but I take a necessity is the mother of invention approach. Mm.
So this is kind of a little bit of a 180, this question. So the reason I asked about the beyond is that I read in actually a few places that you are a good test taker. Yes, right. Okay. You had a gig.
Well,
go ahead.
I was a lot of people in New York City in the 90s were in the performing arts and also tutoring kids for the SAT. And in fact, many long relationships I've had with fellow singer-songwriters started in the Princeton Review office.
No way.
In New York City. Lisa Cornelia was one of them. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you remember David Hamburger, the guitar player and songwriter from those days. He played in various groups and had his own thing. He played with Lisa, and we were just talking about how Lisa and the guys from Five Chinese Brothers were all SAT tutors. I actually was not necessarily a great test taker at the time when I was taking those tests, but I worked my way into it. You could make really good money at that time, and it was a flexible job that happened basically in the early evenings. And if you started getting gigs out of town like I did, you could take them and just tutor the kids the next night.
Oh, wow.
Fun anecdote from those days. Me and my friends would end up tutoring the children of famous people. And at one point, I was tutoring Jan Wenner's middle son, Jan Wenner, the publisher of Rolling mm-hmm. Stone. He was totally nice. His kids were great. And I never even mentioned that I was in music, but I would go down to give a progress report after the session, and there'd be these vintage guitars in the living room, and we'd talk about his son's simultaneous equations progress. Wow. And I would just be laughing inside that I was in the proximity to the person who could make my dreams come true and in no position to broach
right.
it.
Right. You're like, let me sing you this progress report, actually.
I mean, the awkwardness, I just imagined the awkwardness that would ensue yeah. if I tried to give him a demo tape or something.
Oh my gosh, good job.
I was hip enough in those days to know what not to do
yeah.
in most cases.
You're known for your dry, quirky sense of humor. Speaking of, you grew up in Los Angeles. So growing up, where did you experience weirdness and humor?
Interestingly, all around, but especially on, wait for this, volleyball courts. you're not the only one who can do a left turn, Cindy.
Yep.
I was a young volleyball enthusiast. In fact, I played volleyball in college, and now 30 years later have been involved in coaching for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. But what, in answer to your actual question, the wit of the Southern California beaches in the late 70s and through the 80s was on beach volleyball courts. And, you learn some bad behaviors, and it also sharpens you up for your future songwriting career, wow, as it turns out. And it's a the beach volleyball people that I looked up to in my childhood were just the funniest, craziest people you could ever imagine. And I think I might have been predisposed to sharp wit, but they brought it out in me. And it hasn't always served me that well, as a matter of fact. When I worked corporate jobs after my first music career, I would get feedback in performance reviews. Literally, people can't understand if you're joking. Because I would be in business meetings and I would deliver a hilarious line with a completely straight face, and the context was was serious enough that people would not be able to tell if I was joking. And I was joking for the most part, but they didn't know that. And so I had to sort of shave that off, because it's not fun to hear that about yourself in your official performance review where your bonus is on the line.
Right.
Your sense of humor is getting in the way of your financial interests.
Well, that makes me wonder, like, how those situations impacted your relationship to humor.
It has made me more thoughtful about when I talk. I warn people that sometimes they can't tell if I'm joking. I've had people tell me that they thought I hated them for the first year that we knew each other. The first year. And so, you know, I've like taken that, I joke about the feedback in a business context, but I've really taken that kind of feedback to heart. And, you know, I'm in my early 50s now. I wrote angry songs in my 20s. And some of those angry songs were funny, and that took the edge off of them. But I've mellowed just naturally, but I've also mellowed somewhat on purpose. It's not, I don't think it's incumbent on me to be so, expressing myself so angrily all the time. It helps that I'm not that way, but at the same time, like, I'm no longer lashing out at anyone in my songs. I really have grown out of that, naturally and intentionally.
I did have a question about angry songs, and I forget where it is, but I think you basically answered it. Why are you getting ahead of me, Bob?
There was a time, I was at a Kerrville Folk Festival one time, and I met that songwriter and guitar player, Jack Williams. You know who I mean?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Yeah, just like a super masterful musician and cool all-around guy.
Old school.
We'd met before, and I said, oh, we met, you know, a couple years ago at this thing. And he goes, he looked at me, he pointed at me, and he goes, angry songs.
Yeah.
It was a little bit of an eye opener. Like, if that's the way I'm going to be remembered, I might need to shift gears just a little bit.
So I read about that story on your website. You did this great blog post called "What Is My Problem?" Highly recommended reading. So you told that story, and you were also talking about how anger used to show up in your songs. How did your relationship to anger and approach evolve? Like, after that Jack Williams story, like, what was the relationship like with anger?
The feedback just built up. And as we discuss this, I'm having a therapeutic moment where I realized that it built up over time. Comments like the Jack Williams one. I mean, I've already given you three examples of times that I've gotten feedback about it. And so I think what happened is that there was, it gets sunk in. I don't have much to be angry about. I grew up privileged. I haven't been commercially successful in music, but I've been artistically successful. I guess you could argue that I have things to be angry about, but you could also argue that I really, really don't. And, you know, it's possible that I just got over myself after my 20s. You know, I was living in New York City. It's somewhat of an angry place. It's possible that if I'd been in the Boston folk scene, I would have been mellower, because I would have had access to, you know, my friend's farm or whatever, and I could have chilled out for a few days. But I think I somewhat grew out of it, but there's an intentional aspect to it. Let me say one more thing about that. I've always been committed to growing as a songwriter, and Joni Mitchell When I got into Joni Mitchell's middle period, Hegira and the Hissing of Summer Lawns in particular, I started exploring more than trying to make a point. In my 20s, I often would be like, here's what I wouldn't necessarily say this in advance, but by the end of the process, I'd think something like, here's the point of this song, here's what I'm trying to say. But once I listened deeply to that middle Joni Mitchell period, also the middle Leonard Cohen period, like The Future, and the one after that, whose name I'm forgetting, what Joni really was doing in songs like Amelia and like Shades of Scarlet Conquering is just exploring and going all over the place and sort of thinking aloud in a coherent manner. And I just started getting really into doing that. And anger just went out the window because I was no longer trying to make a point.
It sounds like the way that you try to improve as a writer helps you also improve as like a human being. Like those two are living in parallel with each other.
You know, I've listened to a thousand podcast interviews with songwriters, and I've always objected to this idea of songwriting having a therapeutic effect. But it almost sounds now like I'm arguing that it does.
Yeah, sorry, bud.
And that I've been a hypocrite all these years.
So before you pursued music professionally, you had a bunch of little side jobs, construction worker, ski instructor, professional beach volleyball for a week. You left music in 2003 to go to business school and get a quote unquote real job. Throughout your life, what has been your relationship to work?
I didn't like work in theory. You know that John Gorka song where he says, I don't like work, but I don't like waste. I really related to that. A land of the bottom line.
Yeah.
But, you know, what I learned when I got into my, let's call it my 30s, I'm really coming across today as like I'm sort of the wise old man, but I realized that I could get interested easily in things. You know, and so that could be something like writing a song, but it could also be something like data entry or, you know, in business context, like working on a spreadsheet and creating an elegant solutions to problems using Excel. Like I just sort of figured out like whatever I set my mind to, as long as I set it, I can actually get interested even working through the tedious parts of it. And so I started to love work. What I didn't like about work, what I never liked about work was like the career development aspect of it, which I was never especially good at. I'm talking about in like working in a formal organization. When do you talk about how great you are and when do you hang back? You know, how do you assert yourself? I was never particularly good at that. And in fact, was somewhat viewed as an eccentric at companies like Clorox as a creative type. Whereas in the music business, I was viewed as indisputably square. You know, it was an interesting change. But the work that I did at those companies, I found totally interesting. Like I was in charge of Glad plastic containers and I had a great experience helping and to some extent leading a turnaround of the plastic containers business. You know, there was a famous graph at the time, famous in certain circles, of our sales plummeting down, 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 and then our sales leveling out. And I took great pride in the fact that I had something to do with that. And, you know, the career management parts aside, like, I knew that I could, I sort of figured out that I could do things even if they weren't theoretically interesting to me. And another time that I encountered that was when I made my comeback album in, I don't know when that was, 2014. Yeah. I got on the phone with a publicist and I asked, okay, what's going on? What are we doing now in the music business? And he said, you make videos and then you get the videos premiered. And I, for about 5 minutes, was having a meltdown because I didn't want to spend $10,000 to make a music video. Mm-hmm. But then 5 minutes after that, I realized that I could just learn how to make a music video myself, and they could probably be done purely on an iPhone. You know, shoot it, cut it on an iPhone. And so I dove into the concept of making videos, and I'm not like great at it now, but I have a couple of different video concepts that I use when I want to make one. And it's totally satisfying to do that part of the work for me. And I've done that with so many things, home recording. So many of us had to figure out home recording during COVID, but every time I come up against a barrier like videos or home recording, I remind myself, if you just look into this, you'll get interested and you can probably follow it through. Now, when I wanted to make an animated video, I reached my limit. You know, I'm never, ever going to be an animator. And so then I found an inexpensive way of doing that, you know, which was pretty satisfying. So you can hit your limits. But, you know, my advice to anyone who's doing this or doing anything is, and by the way, I give this advice to my kids all the time. Just try doing the thing, follow it down the path a little bit, and see if you don't get into it. I bet you will.
Wow, I relate to that so hard. I want to talk about your time in New York, which sounds like a really special and kind of like iconic time of moving to New York as a singer-songwriter. You said since about fifth grade, I'd harbor musical ambitions, and following two of my best friends to New York seemed like a decisive way to finally pursue them. Hooray. How do you think moving to New York at that particular time, was it like the early 90s? What year was that?
Yeah, it was like 94, 90, 95. Okay. Let's call it the mid-90s.
The mid-90s. How do you think moving to New York City during the mid-90s impacted the type of musician and songwriter you'd become?
There's two ways to answer that. One is I just needed to be somewhere other than Southern California to reinvent myself as a singer-songwriter. You know, there's that famous adage, you can't go home again, mm-hmm. or, you know, it could be modified to say you can't just stay home and be someone other than who you were growing up.
Yeah.
Like I needed to make some sort of move in order to become the person I had in the back of my mind. And New York just happened to be a relatively easy solution because my two friends really had just moved there semi-spontaneously. You know, it didn't hurt that we were under the influence of people like Henry Miller, you know, who won Reeds in college, or Jack Kerouac. Those two friends actually had done the whole Paris thing some time before that. So New York was actually, you know, a pretty tame solution compared to what it could have been. But that's the first way of answering it, of that question, which is I just needed to go somewhere else. You know, this probably would have happened anywhere, but in New York, I fell in with a group of songwriters. I started going to open mics at the Sidewalk Cafe. And then at that time, and only for that very brief time in the mid-90s, there was a place called the Fast Folk Cafe, which Jack Hardy had founded in Tribeca. And simultaneously, I was going to the anti-folk open mic at Sidewalk Cafe, and like the straightforward folk open mic at the Fast Folk Cafe. And
Bob Hillman, he lives in both worlds.
I mean, everyone kind of did. It was consecutive nights and you'd see all the same people and it was super fun
Can you throw out some names of like who is hanging around the Fast Folk and who's hanging around the anti-folk? Actually, do you want me to guess?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Yeah, that'll be fun.
Anti-folk, Jemai, Regina Spektor, Don Landis.
She wasn't there yet. Don Landis was in the Fast Folk.
Well, she was another one that I was going to say that she could probably hang in both worlds.
I don't remember. So Regina Spektor came later, but Don Landis came to our Monday night songwriters meetings at Jack Hardy's place for a long time. You know, and then things happened for her from there for various reasons, some of which have to do with the group. You know, mm-hmm. But she was after the Fast Folk Cafe period, okay. So she would never have gone to that. Sidewalk Cafe was this guy Latch, L-A-C-H. He ran the place, but I don't really remember that many artists who I would associate with that particular scene. Mm-hmm. Fast Folk, though, at the time was Wendy Beckerman, Tim Robinson, that guy Hamill on Trial was around at the time.
Yeah.
who was passing through. He just moved to New York, but he was going to the open mic right before he made a major label album. This was even before he was on Righteous Babe.
Right.
He had a deal with Mercury or something. And there was this guy, Alan Andrews, who unfortunately died, but was quite a character. There was Django Haskins. There was Pete Gallob. And just like really a long Ina May Wool is another person that was around during that period.
I've heard that name. Mm-hmm. These are a lot of people I don't know, mainly because I was in Boston at the time, not in New York.
Kevin Stowe would come down.
Okay.
Kevin Stowe would come down to Fast Folk. And then we quickly became friends with Carl Cacho.
Mm-hmm.
You must know Carl,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I know Carl.
And so there ended up being like a cross pollination that occurred. But you know, we're talking about obscure groups of people here. Frank Tedesco is another one. Richard Julian is on the more well known side.
I'm having a great time right now. Jesse Harris.
Jim Allen is another one. Yeah, Jesse Harris. Not so much at Fast Folk. Jesse Harris was. And Richard Julian and Jesse Harris were good friends, and but they were more. I picture them more at the 55 bar,
or the living room,
to jazz. Well, then the living room was the next phase.
Wow.
So
sorry, everybody. This is fun for me and Bob. And no one else.
When I first started, Shanae was the singer-songwriter spot.
Oh, okay.
Which everyone knows from the
Jeff Buckley
album.
Yep.
I couldn't get a gig at Shanae, and there was a good reason for that. I wasn't ready, and my music wasn't ready for that room.
Mm-hmm.
But then the living room opened, and all the people I just listed and a lot more people played that little room at the living room, which was free. And they would just pile us up one after the other. And, you know, in my memory, I was there two or three nights a week listening to a friend play. That was really our community. And I got to know the people that worked there. And that was a magical period before it moved to the second location, which was bigger.
Okay.
At which point I had moved, I think, and I wasn't really involved.
Right.
But that first living room period was about as exciting as it got.
It passed around like a fire bucket so you could put tips in it.
Yeah. Yeah,
I remember.
It wasn't like a great money-making opportunity.
No. The community, I think, is what people are hanging out for. And then you'd go get like a vegan cupcake afterwards from the Cake Records. And then you'd go get a sandwich at Katz's.
You know what I would do is that I would go to a Mexican restaurant called El Sombrero, but we called it The Hat because that's English for El Sombrero.
The Hat. That's so funny.
And they had, you could choose blended or on the rocks martinis, but the blended martinis had an opiate effect.
Ooh, that sounds disgusting, actually.
No, it was really fun.
Okay. I won't be trying.
It was not, it was like on the happy side of opiates, if that such a thing exists.
Man, somebody told me the other day mixing, I think it was like coffee. No, wait, what was it? I'll have to get back to you, but it sounds disgusting, but it was great. It was like brandy and something. I think I remember who it was.
What about like a blackberry mango sparkling water? Would that appeal to
Disgusting.
You?
Disgusting. I would think that it would be really good, but it's actually gross. Okay. That was fun. I really enjoyed that. It's like not very often that you get to like dig into the early 2000s, late 90s singer-songwriter crowd in New York. Okay, so Bob Hillman, you had some success with your first three records, industry connections, festival bookings, opening slots, opening for all of Suzanne Vega's Songs in Red and Gray tour, which is a great record and a great tour. But you opted to walk away from this career. You wanted a sustainable career, so you went to Iowa with your fiancé, who then became your wife. Is that how the story goes? Okay.
Yes.
You attended business school in Iowa. So here's the question. It seems like it was like a really abrupt switch. Like you're on stage opening for Suzanne Vega, and then like a month later, you're in a classroom. What was that juxtaposition like for you in terms of like identity, like self-identity?
It was good and bad. Here's how it was good. I'm really proud of the fact that I switched careers abruptly. I really made a 90-degree turn, and I did it before it was too late, before I was unemployable in some other capacity, because I had an inkling that I could pursue other interests and be successful. You know, like there's nothing I like more than being a singer-songwriter. I really live for it. It defines me almost completely. But at the same time, I wasn't getting, I mean, I had done like 75 dates with Suzanne Vega in the US and Europe, and audiences are responding great.
Mm-hmm.
Even Suzanne would tell you that in Luxembourg, I sold more CDs than she did.
Oh, wow. Wow.
It's a small country. And so it's not where you hang your hat. Luxembourg is no one's claim to fame. But that night in Luxembourg, there was a line from the sound desk to the door with people that had responded to my music. And it was very exciting.
Yeah.
You know, I met her agent, who was very cool to me, who was also the agent of David Bowie and the Rolling Stones. And, you know, one night on the bus, now I'm totally spacing on her name, the super famous singer-songwriter from Vancouver, Sarah
McLachlan.
Yeah, was sitting on our bus, you know. So things like that were happening. But I somehow wasn't getting a signal from the music business.
Mm-hmm.
And I've written blog posts exploring that. I think I touch on it probably in What Is My Problem, but there's another one called About Why I Quit. And, you know, it might have to do with the angry songs. It might have to do with how I was interacting with people, but I wasn't getting a signal from the business. No one wanted to, like, sign me to a record deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and at the time, like, Mark Arelli was on Signature Sounds and Josh Ritter was on V2. He had just gotten a deal with V2. And I was not taking meetings making the progress that I thought I should be making.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did make, at the same time, the internet bubble had burst and 9/11 had happened.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife was out of a job in San Francisco and she was accepted to the Iowa Writers Workshop. And so, interestingly, here's a fun fact. My previous girlfriend had also gone to the Iowa Writers Workshop.
Mm.
And so I had spent time in Iowa City and it was fine with me. And so I was on the road with Suzanne. And so we just moved to Iowa. But after the first year there was when I had the realization that I wasn't getting the signals that I needed
mm-hmm.
to. You know, was I going to wait it out for 20 years to see if I could be a road warrior? I didn't really want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the right choice for some people, but it didn't feel like the right choice for me. And so I made that 90-degree turn and got real jobs. But the first week in business school at the University of Iowa, I was in a group, assigned to a group that was going to discuss some case study. And one of the guys in the group goes, I saw you at Iowa State opening for Todd Snyder 3 months ago. It was awesome. And I was totally depressed after that because what is more fun than opening for Todd Snyder in a totally full room?
I mean, that's my dream day. You know, that's the dream afternoon. Yeah. Right?
Right. And so having it sort of mirrored back to me in that way made everything feel like a big mistake.
Mm.
You know, but I powered through and, you know, I don't know if going to business school in Iowa was the solution to all my problems, but it did eventually get me to some decent business type jobs.
Yeah.
You know, for the 10 years that I did that.
Also being around the other students in Iowa City, you said many of them were younger and they were politically conservative, which is different than you. How did that experience help you connect with people whose beliefs and viewpoints might be different than yours?
It helped a little. It was a frustrating experience because I felt like I was around a lot of people who were not talking sense. for two straight years. But we're talking about people who are really nice and really smart. And I was able to see past politics as long as politics wasn't constantly being discussed. I mean, at the end of year banquet, they gave me and another guy a joke award for being liberal. That was viewed as a joke in that community. So, you know, it was a fairly extreme shift from what I was used to, but mm-hmm. I could respect people for being nice and smart. And, I don't have a lot of friendships ongoing from those days, but I look back fondly on some of the times.
Okay. After you finish 2 years of business school, you head into the workforce. What is your reaction to the way the business world works in terms of like getting a job, making money, having benefits, having vacation time versus the music world?
It was nice to know what was going to happen next. I had not had health insurance for a really long time. And so that was nice. I could go to a doctor. I kind of always knew
where
my
next
meal was
coming from. Was it nice or was it I would imagine it being mind blowing. Where you're I can apply for a job and then I get it and then I have benefits and a 401k?
It was only nice. It wasn't mind-blowing. Okay. You know, because I continually struggled with where I fit into it all. I'd gone from, we talked earlier about how I moved to New York to reinvent myself as a singer-songwriter. That was my conception of self. Mm-hmm. And my conception of self was not reinventing myself as the brand manager of Formula 409. Mm. Yeah, my conception of self took a little bit of a hit mm-hmm. when I was doing those things.
Okay.
On the other hand, making money was great. And by the time I was in those jobs, I had a baby. And so I was home. My worst nightmare had always been if I'm having to slog it out on the road when I have kids, there's so many examples of that, of those relationships not working out. And, it was something I could control. Mm. I could choose slogging it out on the road with divorce potentially in my future. Maybe not. There are examples of it working out, but there's so many examples of it not working out. Yeah. And I felt like I was making a decision that would probably play out pretty well for me long term, given the odds of making it in the music business. Mm.
How did your, thinking about all of that, your identity of self as a singer-songwriter and a musician. So how did your creativity and musician spirit help you in your business career?
Well, first of all, just by saying you were a musician and being able to point to some evidence that you were, which I've always been able to do because I did check a few boxes along the way. If you're working at a job in Oakland and you say you played the Fillmore, that is credibility building for you, So there's some of that sort of built in. But, what I did really after my first son was about one and I came out of the fog, I just got back down to business and became a singer-songwriter again. Mm. And the main way I did that was that my good friend Wendy Beckerman had also moved out to the Bay Area and we started a monthly songwriter meeting in the vein of Jack Hardy's weekly songwriters meeting that went on forever in New York. Mm-hmm. And so, a song a month is not a lot, but it was something for me to hang my hat on. And, I didn't record for a while there, but after a couple of years of doing that, I can literally remember the moment I was sitting in a cubicle on the 22nd floor of an office building in Oakland. And I thought, I'm going to ask Peter Case to produce a record for me because I got a bunch of songs. And so I knew him, so I called him, and he was like, okay. And then, a year later, we were doing it.
Nice.
So I never really strayed that far afield. It was always in the back of my mind, and then I was always doing it on some level. Cool. And it's kind of ramped back up from there.
So you have three sons. Is that right?
Two
sons.
Two.
Your sons... Prior to 2014, 2015, your sons had really it sounds like even though you did keep up with songwriting and music, they didn't know you as Bob Hillman, the musician, which was that huge part of your identity again. So what were your feelings around introducing them to Bob Hillman, the musician?
They are resistant to Bob Hillman, the musician.
No!
They think Bob Hillman, the musician, is ridiculous. And they somewhat deny his existence.
No.
It's possible that my wife isn't that different from me in terms of her approach to humor. And so it's possible that we've instilled in our children a cynical brand of humor that has, you know, where I've sort of made my bed here and now I have to take a lot of shit for my kids, for my music. And, you know, they're very numbers oriented in their social media approach. And so they see how many monthly listeners I have, or they see how many followers I have, and it doesn't match the music they're listening to. And therefore it's not to be taken seriously.
Oh.
Type thing.
Keep
I don't think they've ever seen me play. Yeah. You know, one time I took one of my kids to go see the Weepies at the Great American Music Hall, which is like a 500 seat venue. Mm-hmm. And I had just opened two shows for them in the Northwest, mm-hmm. you know, at theaters where they put 500 to 1,000 people into the seats. And so I was like, you know, I'll take Sebastian to this. There was some reason I took him. Maybe it was just us. I couldn't leave him home alone or something. And so we waltz into the Great American Music Hall and we go straight backstage and he's talking to Steve and Deb, the stars, mm-hmm. you know, and he just could not have cared less. I was kind of hoping to be like, look, you know, daddy walks through this door, but those other people don't. It didn't work at all. Crickets. He ended up playing video games with one of their kids.
Oh, right.
That was
yeah.
the idea of fun.
Yeah, yeah. They have some sons too. Yeah. That's so funny. That's like the exact opposite of my reaction the last time I saw Deb Talon, which was just openly weep into her arms. If the two extremes.
It's well known that Deb Talon is a genius songwriter, and whatever she does has meaning. So I, of course, was moved, but my son was not. Only because he wasn't opening himself to it.
Mm, right. Give him some time.
There's still hope, yeah. is what I'm saying. Yeah.
Okay. So, Bob, I just love your LinkedIn bio. May I read it for our listeners who may not be familiar?
I suppose.
Okay, here we go. Consumer-focused marketing professional with 10 years of experience in entrepreneurial environments within small and large organizations. Expert in implementing strategic, creative, integrative marketing programs across traditional and digital media. Extensive experience overseeing new product development from ideation through launch. Strong collaborator with proven success working in complex, highly matrixed organizations. Wow. How have all these wonderful skills translated to musician Bob Hillman 2.0?
Well, I think I've proven beyond the shadow of a doubt that I'm good with words.
That's so good.
But I actually have a serious answer to that question. When I went to work at Clorox, which was my second job, I worked for a natural products company in a cornfield in Iowa for 2 years, which was my first foray into the full-time work world. But it was a smaller company. But when I went to Clorox, I thought, I can't believe I'm going to go to this company that's so buttoned up and full of process. There was a process for everything. And so I go to work there, and what I learn is that process is amazing. It wasn't constricting at all. You know, it wasn't the slightest bit constricting. In fact, it begot creativity. The story, the anecdote I always throw out in conversations like this is, if you go to the Picasso Museum in Paris, you see that Picasso painted figuratively when he was young, before he did all the crazy stuff that he did. If you have process, then you can have creativity in its context. If I go on stage and don't know the words to my songs, which is basically what happens all the time now, because I've written a lot of new songs and I don't perform very much, mm-hmm. I have to concentrate all of my being on remembering the words to those songs, because that's what's important to me, is being able to communicate the song fundamentally. But if I do know the words, then I can actually imbue it with meaning or improvise in the context of a song, which is something I've experimented with over the years. So I learned, completely surprisingly, that being buttoned up and having process is not the worst thing in the world. Mm. And so I applied that way of thinking to everything I do in music. And I honestly think, you know, listen, I'm still not successful from a business standpoint, but I've got my act pretty much together. And the reason I have it together is because of clear thinking, clear focused thinking, and you know, setting objectives, knowing what I'm trying to accomplish in advance, and then within the context of that objective, taking this path or that to the end. Hmm.
Another question gleaned from your What Is My Problem blog post. You said, I've always gravitated towards purists like Jack Hardy, who espoused art over commerce with evangelical ardor. How has this continued to be a North Star for you?
It's an accidental North Star. It literally just who I gravitate towards. The Peter Cases of the world, the Dan Burns of the world, who you know, are so committed to their creativity, and you know, have achieved commercial success, but it hasn't been their primary focus. I just really care about the songs that move me, and I'm trying to make up songs that move other people, and I don't think that much about where it's going from a commercial standpoint.
The new EP, Downtown in the Rain, produced by Greg Leese. That's how you say it, right?
It wasn't produced by Greg, but he plays on it and you pronounced it perfectly.
Okay, great. Damn, I messed up my facts, got the pronunciation. I did a lot of research on that. Bob, this is a very folky acoustic EP. You say, this is probably what my first few albums should have sounded like, but I wanted to be a folk rock guy, which I feel like can be attributed to Peter Case, who you have been a fan of since the late 80s. You saw Peter Case in 1989 at McCabe's, where it sounds like you were enchanted by his rock and roll energy as a solo performer. But, you know, you are who you are. How do you see rock and roll, or the like rock side of your folk rock, coming out in these songs?
The way I've made, what I do now is that I make short albums, I guess you could say EPs. And I have a group of songs that make sense together, and then I envision a sound and sort of cast it with the musicians that might make sense for that context. And I just had this group of songs that seemed to lend itself to a more acoustic format, simultaneously at a time where I thought to myself, Greg Leese is a musician I've always wanted to work with. I know his playing from Dave Alvin records, from Peter Case records. You know, and your audience will probably know that he's well known for having played with Joni Mitchell. He plays a lot with Bill Frisell. He's in Jackson Browne's band. He's a seriously heavy musician, but I've sort of followed his career from the beginning of it. And because we had friends in common, I could send him an email. Mm. And so, you know, all that at the same time was like, well, here's the record I would love to do next. Here's the short record I would love to do next, because I have the songs and I have the people in mind. And so, you know, I just moved forward with that because I could. Restate the question because I got distracted.
How do you see rock and roll, or the rock side of your rock coming out on these songs?
Yeah, you know, so, you know, I'm simultaneously to making that record with Greg, I was making a record that can actually be called power pop. Power pop to the extent that the drummer is Pete Thomas from The Attractions. And so, I was working in a rock vein at the same, literally at the same time as I was working in a more folk vein. And so with the folk material on Downtown in the Rain, I think there's rock energy in what I'm singing about and how I'm singing it. Hmm. That's probably the simplest answer I can give. You know, it doesn't have like a electric guitar on it. It has pedal steel and lap steel, but it's not hard driving in any way. Mm-hmm. There's no percussion or any kind of drums on it. but there's just a, you know, there's energy behind what I'm trying to communicate that I think probably suggests that idea of a solo performer with rock energy. Mm.
Maria Taylor, who I love, singing all over the EP. She's been in Bright Eyes, Azure Ray, and has great solo records. She was also on your 2020 EP. You posted recently, you said, I've never actually met Maria Taylor, but she's become my go-to harmony partner. What do you like about singing with Maria? Will you ever meet?
Yeah, you know, of course,
wrong
never
answers
having
only.
Met, we've never actually, we've never actually sung together.
Right.
Because we've only, she's only
That's
overdubbed
okay.
remotely. The reason I work with her is that my musical collaborator and producer, Johnny Flower, he's a bass player in Los Angeles, who also has played with the Weepies, actually. He's good friends with her, and he suggested her for the first project we worked on together. And it just sounded great, and we wanted a female voice for this project as well, and she was his logical choice. He's also brought in other female singers. From my album, Some of Us Are Free, Some of Us Are Lost, we worked with Laura Mace. We work with Sarah Dugas, but Maria has just brought to the table a sound that's working well. You know, she's pretty adventurous. She doesn't just, you know, she tries stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Not that the other women don't, they all do too, but mm-hmm. I love when Laura tries stuff and builds on, you know, builds beyond what I think is possible. Like, you know, the one voice harmony that we can all hear. She'll build beyond that. Mm. She's a real pro.
Bob, before I let you go, would you like to do the lightning round?
I would like to do that because I'm a listener to your podcast.
Ah.
I thought about your lightning round before and I should have been prepared.
Ah, well, these
and
are
I deeply, deeply regret it.
These are special Bob Hillman questions. So some of them
okay.
have not ever been asked. So here we go.
Okay.
A special Bob Hillman lightning round. Question number one, what is your favorite Tolstoy novel?
War and Peace, which I've read 3 times.
Wow, impressive. Bob, you are downtown in the rain. Umbrella or raincoat?
Raincoat. I make a point of behaving like I'm philosophically opposed to umbrellas for reasons I can't recall.
That sounds good. Who's the funniest musician? Living or dead?
The name is not coming to me of the guy. Tom Lehrer.
Wait.
Tom Lehrer.
Keep going.
Do I have that name right? Tom Lehrer, the jazzy singer-songwriter, semi-obscure. But I've also been cracked up by Dan Byrne more than just about anyone.
Mm. Okay. Those are good ones. I'll have to look.
Loudon Wainwright's another funny. Loudon Wainwright,
oh
the acid
God,
song.
Yeah.
There's a funny song.
Oh my God. Dogs or cats?
Dogs.
What is your coffee order?
Black coffee, as large as possible.
That's good. What is one product you cannot live without?
That's a very challenging lightning round question. The Glad container that is the shallow square is a great solution to all of your food storage needs.
Oh my God. This is the last question. It does not have to be Clorox related. What is your ideal vacation?
I have 2 ideal vacations. Ideal vacation number 1 is hiking in the mountains, ideally staying in a cabin that has some cozy qualities to it. Ideal vacation number 2 is at a beach, potentially without my kids, so that I can actually relax instead of just playing pool games.
How old are your kids?
Well, now they're teenagers. 14, wait, did one just turn 15? 15 and 16 and a half. But if we were at a pool, we'd still play pool games.
That's kind of cute, though.
Oh, it's so fun. I'm good at pool games. We've made up our fair share over the years. And I love doing them, but once in a while, I would like to read a book on the side.
Okay. Maybe a different Tolstoy novel. Bob Hillman, the new EP, Downtown in the Rain. It's been a lot of fun getting to know what you've been up to these past several years. And hope we get to see each other in person again.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on the show. I'm a listener, and I'm really proud of having this opportunity.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by Anthony Cabrera. Our music composed by Alex Stanton. Basic Folk is on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. You can find all of our episodes there. Check us out on FolkAlley.com or at Folk Alley's mobile app. You can search for us in the SiriusXM app by looking for Basic Folk. You can find us wherever you get podcasts, or you can go to our website, BasicFolk.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, we suggest sharing it with a friend, perhaps that friend who moved to New York City and said, hey, if I can make it here, I can make it anywhere. And then they didn't make it, and they moved to Nantucket or to Detroit, and they made it in Nantucket or Detroit. That's just as good. Send them this episode as some life inspo. And thanks. Thank you for listening all the way to the end. You are so special and dear to us here. And we'll talk to you next time. Bye.